Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, indeed. And this week we're going to rename the podcast the Victor Frankenstein Fan Club, because we're huge fans of Victor.
Oh, who isn't? That lovable scamp.
Lovable scamp Victor Frankenstein.
I think that's how he sees himself.
I'm sure. This is episode number 125, and we're going to talk about Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, the novel, not any of the movies.
I know.
Yes.
The movie or the book that makes you realize how the movies just cherry-picked a few elements.
Yeah, for sure. This is one of those books that I think that everybody thinks that they know. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember saying this about Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's like everybody thinks that they know this book, but if they haven't read it, they really don't. Because
yes.
None of the films or none of the cultural things that have come out of it. I mean, there's some basis in there, but that's not what the book is. I meant to rewatch that Kenneth Branagh version to see how close it was, but I didn't get that done. But I remember there was some significant differences even in that. That, you know, didn't quite make it. So I urge people to read this book. I really, really like it. This is probably my third time through.
Me too. Mm-hmm. Also my third time through. And I would say that it's funny, when you go to pick up a copy, you realize there are two different versions of the book. There's the 1818 version, and there is the 1830 version. And you don't really feel like that's a huge deal until you start to read what people say about the two different versions. And evidently, Shelley didn't change the basics, but she changed some of the nuances as she was adding little things or taking things out to kind of reflect the way she felt after her husband had died and various other things that happened in her life. So I hear that there's kind of a different philosophical bent. Nothing that says that Victor is actually a lovable scamp, but I think unknowingly I've read the 1830 version the first couple times, and this time I deliberately sought out the 1818 because for one thing it's supposed to be shorter. And I personally, just coming to it as a reader, didn't notice anything different. I was still left with the same big things that I'd noticed.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So the book was published in 1818-ish, mm-hmm. and then she tinkered with it, and then somehow there was like a re-release in 1830?
In 1830, she went through it again. And for instance, when I was listening to the audiobook that the library had, a wonderful new version with three great actors doing voices, and there was a part in Chapter 2 where Victor's talking about, and I was my parents' first child, and they lavished the attention on me that any children would lavish on their child because they just cared so much, blah, 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 blah. And I went, oh, nice contrast with what I know about how he treats the monster later. So I go to market in my 1818 copy from the library, and I'm like, wait, where is it? It's not here. And there he's just said, you know, and I was the first child, and it was all wonderful. He just says, of these, I was the eldest and the destined successor to all his labors and utility. No creature could have more tender parents than mine. My improvement and health were their constant care, especially as I remained for several years their only child. But first, let me tell you something else. And and things are different. Like she did fix some stuff up to make it more proper, I guess, because in the 1818 version, it's a first cousin who was married to an Italian guy, and everybody died, and the little niece got left with some people. Hmm. Or no, and they just said, oh, please take charge of your niece Elizabeth to Frankenstein's parents. Not this whole thing that's in the 1830 version, which I heard when I was listening to the audiobook about And they came across this family in the countryside, and they couldn't take care of the kids, so they said they'd take one off their hands. And here's one they'd adopted when some rich lady fell ill. She'd changed it so they weren't related.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that when they got married later, he wasn't marrying a first cousin, which I think was considered okay a lot of the time. Mm. But
yeah.
I myself had more things of, you wait, you were raised as brother and sister, and but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if somebody's got to have a, you know, here's the differences, you know, somewhere out there on the internet. I'll see if I can find that.
Yeah, there's an essay in this Norton Critical Edition I have that talks about that. And it's one that I've seen referenced in, oh my gosh, maybe Amazon reviews or something.
Okay.
They'll say, this thing by this lady tells what is different. But just as a reader, I don't feel that way. It's kind of like when you read about different translations of something. You're going to read Dante, for example, and it's mm-hmm. like 12 translations with fierce defenders and fierce detractors.
Oh, wow.
You just have to pick one that seems like it flows for you and go
much
with it.
Much like the Bible, huh?
Yes, you're right.
I've heard there's more than one translation of the Bible.
What?
Wait a minute.
God's sacred word. I think you wrote in English for us.
That's right. And some of them have red letters.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, good. Yeah. So the, I think it's worth mentioning the 1930 film as well. Was it 1930 or 1931 with Boris Karloff?
Oh.
And that is probably the cultural version of Frankenstein, right? It's the one that people seem to know, and the one that people seem to think that this book is, mm-hmm. if they haven't read it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like the movie, but there's a lot of differences. But it's well worth watching. It's about an hour long, okay. But it's fun to watch. It's for historical reasons, and then you're just watching it, and you can see all these things that, you know, people have referred to over the years and various other movies. yeah, as a Hollywood historical event, I think it's worth watching.
Well, and I do know that for Young Frankenstein, which is the only Frankenstein version I've ever seen, which tends to hew more closely to the book than you might think in some ways, but they were such fans of the original movie that Mel Brooks went and found all that equipment that was used as a prop in the movie, and that's what's in his Young Frankenstein.
Oh, very good.
It's
very
all
good.
The original stuff.
I love it.
Yeah.
That is a cool tidbit, and makes, you know, yeah. I do love Young Frankenstein.
Well, you know, it's more style.
You bet. All right, well, let's talk about this book.
Okay.
Yeah, the book starts off with a guy. I think his name is Walston.
Walton.
He's sailing north on an adventure, and very poetic, romantic language. He's writing to, is it his wife or his sister? Okay. And he's just describing, you know, I must go and see, you know, what may not be expected in a country of eternal light. I'm going to go and enlighten myself. It's going to be amazing. And while he's cruising around, not very competently, this sled drives by, pulled by dogs, and he's like, well, that's odd. And then shortly thereafter, I think it was the next morning, right next to the ship, which is, I think it was socked in by ice, which we know everything about now.
I thought of, you prepared us well.
That's right. This is another one in my series of pole version, North and South Pole based fiction.
We're going to have to read the narrative of Arthur Pym,
I think
that does the same thing, right?
Exactly. So off to the side of the ship is Victor Frankenstein. And they talk him into coming on the ship, and that's something that I remember. He's like, you know, he didn't really want to get on, but We talked him into it. So the guy, they pull him in there, and then Victor Frankenstein, after a while, he says, "You're probably interested in what my story is, because isn't everyone? Because I am pretty awesome."
That pretty much sets the tone for Victor.
Yeah, that's Victor Frankenstein. Yeah. And then the story shifts from these letters that Walton wrote into the story that Victor Frankenstein tells Walton. And I don't know, the next third of the book or so is Victor Frankenstein telling his story. Mm-hmm. And it ends up that he's chasing the sled that went by the day before, mm-hmm. which has a monster on it.
A huge man.
A huge man. So, now Victor Frankenstein, you know, we did set the tone of what kind of person he is, but he is on a quest. Well, there's a lot of things that contribute to this, but he has found himself very interested in life and life essences and the sciences and lightning and all this kind of thing. And he becomes obsessed with it, and he starts to believe that he can create life. And he manages to do so, and he creates this monster, or the creature is what it's called.
Yeah, demon in here sometimes he calls it.
Right. So Frankenstein is not a monster. Frankenstein is Victor Frankenstein. Well, he's his own monster, right?
Right. Right. But, the other thing is we all call the monster Frankenstein.
Right, and that's not so. The monster is the creature. So he creates this creature in his lab, and is immediately repulsed by what he's done, because the thing is not nice to look at, and he runs away in horror.
You also wonder if this is where Lovecraft got his propensity for having his heroes faint a lot. He's continually fainting, running away, fainting, and then getting sick.
That's right. And this is telling about Victor's character. So he runs away and he faints. He's exhausted. You know, these are his excuses. He's exhausted. He's got the vapors or whatever. I don't think it used that word, but he's just like, I can't continue. This thing is so horrible. And then he runs away from this apartment that he's been doing his stuff in. And then he comes back to the apartment later and he's like opening the door. Hello, anyone here? And there's nobody there. The creature has left. And he's like, oh, thank God. Thank God that creature's gone, right? He's like, luck that I don't have to take care of this.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
You're right. That does set the tone for everything. And there's also something he says when he's talking about getting ready to, you know, basically bring it to life, or mm-hmm. you know, do his experiment. He says, "No one can conceive the variety of feelings which bore me onwards like a hurricane in the first enthusiasm of success. Life and death appeared to me ideal bounds, which I should first break through and pour a torrent of light into our dark world. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. Many happy and excellent natures would owe their being to me. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs." You know, and you're just like, wow, so noble.
Yes.
Not. Yeah, it's me, 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 me. He's entitled. And that's it. And when anything goes wrong, it's never, this is terrible. What should we do? It's like, oh, thank goodness the monster's gone. I don't have to deal with it. Or later on, it's, oh, poor Justine.
Yeah.
But you know what? She gets to die and she's out of it. I have to live with this. Oh, I'm the saddest person in the world. And you're just like, Victor, do you hear what you're saying?
Oh, I know. I know. Yeah.
You wonder, because the story is and it's been corroborated that it was, let's see, Mary Shelley, her husband, the poet Percy Shelley.
Percy, yeah.
Lord Byron, who was, you know, Mr. Drama King of his time, and John Poldari, who's a friend and I think a doctor, who was traveling with them. And they were staying at Lake Geneva. It was very rainy. And they all said, let's do a ghost story. And she thought and thought for a couple of days, couldn't think of anything, and then had a dream, which was the creation and bringing to life of the monster. And so then she started working with that to write this story. And you kind of wonder if some of her life being surrounded by people like Shelley, who wasn't like, you know, the greatest guy ever, or Byron, made her kind of put some of those elements into Victor Frankenstein.
Yeah, you'd think so. Yeah, kind of he's not a flattering person, and I don't think she meant him to be.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, so she was throwing that out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know if this was an ideal type of a person in her eyes in any way, but it certainly seems like the people she was hanging out with were somewhat like that, right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Byron, he's the one who, let's see, he had an affair with Lady Caroline Lamb and then just dropped her, and she basically went nuts and started stalking him and maybe went into a decline that killed her. I believe he's the charming one. It was his sister, his half-sister was definitely a serious fling. Mary Shelley's, was it her sister? See, I'm loose on all this, but it's basically one set of horrendous relationships after another. And you just go, oh my gosh. Yeah. And people will say that, you know, this was Mary Shelley's commentary on the Romantics, who these guys definitely were. And they loved nature. Nature was, you know, paramount to all. And it's her look at all that stuff through this relationship.
Yeah. And it's life without consequence, right?
Yeah,
it's like, you know, with natural winds pushing us here and there, we're not really quite responsible because we're part of nature and all that. And that is reflected in Victor, in his decisions, because it's like Victor is, you know, he doesn't want responsibility for what he's done. And right. I think that's one of the main themes of the book is responsibility, because he has done something incredible and won't assume responsibility for it.
Yeah, he never, ever assumes responsibility for, even when he's, well, we can wait till we're talking about the end of the book.
Yeah.
But he makes a speech at the end of the book, and I'm like, wow, you learned zip. And I have to say, the framing story this time through of Walton, who's telling the story, because even when the story is being told by Frankenstein, he is relating it he's telling it in first person as Frankenstein, but he's basically, and sister, I will now tell you what he said. Because then later, it's interesting because it's this series of embedded stories, because then Frankenstein tells him, and then I got to talk to the monster, and here's what he told me. So it all turns into the monster's point of view before it works its way back out again.
Right.
And I had realized it, but I hadn't noticed the first two times through how important the Walton is in that framing story and how he is showing us something very important also.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, he actually is the character who shows growth in the whole thing, in my opinion.
That's a good point. I hadn't realized that either.
Yeah.
This time through, I was thinking, you know, about all the characters. And, you know, this has been called a feminist novel before. Mm-hmm. But it's not feminist in a way that there are strong females in there, because there really isn't. You don't see a lot of female characters here. They're there, but these are definitely from the points of view of Victor and Walton and the creature.
Yeah.
But all of the male characters, the main male characters, like Walton, who does stumble about a little bit incompetently, and Victor, who is pretty horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's like he's the monster of this story.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be feminist in that it's holding up these icons of male I'm searching for a word here. Whatever's going on at that time, you know, what these ideal, quote, you know, males, they're almost like parodies of the ideal of the time.
Yeah. And I did read something that was pointing out that it could be, although she's not stating it explicitly, but one reason Victor is so awful with this monster or his creature is that he's not a woman. Is that the creation, bringing new life into the world, should be reserved to women or to God, who will be empathetic, who care even if somebody's ugly or doesn't look like they think it will. They will still nurture and take care of it. And the women are all fairly passive. But when you think about it, that's even what Elizabeth is trying to do for Victor when he's just having one meltdown after another. And she's like, but you still want to get married, right? There's not someone else is there. And you're just like, oh my gosh, Elizabeth, what is wrong with you? But she is at the same time trying to help him and take care of him. She's kind of going, oh, okay. It's the same way his father does to him, a parent.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, if Victor Frankenstein was female, you would think that she would care for the creature.
And part of this could be because I know that part of what was going on in Mary Shelley's life was she and Percy Shelley had had a baby who died. Hmm. And evidently he wasn't like the most, I mean, I'm sure he was upset by it, but he wasn't like showing it. And this was a source of conflict for them. So I could be reading into it too much. But when you look at it, you know, Justine's character is also, she's passive in terms of moving action in the book. But she is about the only other nurturing person that you see. You know, she's out looking for the little boy who's missing. She, you know, all these various things.
Right, right. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, you know, I'm thinking about it in kind of a different way here.
Well, do we need to, I guess.
Yeah, let's keep going. So Victor Frankenstein, you know, he tells his story. And after the creature's gone, you know, he basically packs up his stuff and goes home. Which is Geneva, I believe.
Yeah, well, he's sick for several months.
Yeah, of course. He's got the vapors or whatever. He's like, I am so awesome that I've fainted.
Yeah, and his good friend was there.
Yeah.
He managed to hold it together long enough to meet his good friend and then pass out. So somebody was there to take care of him.
Oh, perfect. Oh, perfect. So, yeah, so he heals up, right. But then he goes home.
Yeah.
And why he's home. So he's got Elizabeth, who you mentioned, who is a cousin or not, depending on the version, right?
Yeah.
And there's also in the family Justine, who you mentioned, who was also adopted in the family.
Well, she's a servant who they essentially adopted, but she's a servant. Right. Yeah.
And then there was a young boy.
Is that Ernest?
Yeah, William or something like that. I don't know. So, yeah, but there was a young boy who also joins the family.
Brothers, yeah.
Right. So, he's got all that going for him, and in Geneva, but things start to go awry.
Go ahead. There, yeah, isn't it when he gets there, hasn't William disappeared and nobody knows where he is?
Okay, I couldn't remember if that was at the very instant, but yeah. So his little brother is gone, and Justine is blamed for his murder.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, he doesn't know anything at this point about, you know, but he suspects. There's a point at which he's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is probably the creature who did this.
Yeah, I think he saw it out of the corner of his eye when he was like, you know, dreamily looking at the lake or something, and it was dark, and he was like, that was my creature.
Right.
And then when Williams disappeared, he's like, oh, I know what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so Justine is blamed for the murder and ends up paying the price for it.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's only got Elizabeth left. But at that point they switch to the creature's point of view, which is the most amazing part of this book and the part that I absolutely love.
I know. I love that, there are the themes and, Heather Ord over at Craftlit covered Frankenstein, and at one point Rose had written a paper about the theme of ice in the book, and they talked about it. But I was just, and I don't remember, unfortunately, really what they said, but I was thinking about the fact that when Frankenstein meets the creature to hear his story, he's on this huge glacier. He's just gone out for a day's walk, and he's going to walk around this glacier by himself. Ice is so predominant whenever the monster's around or the creature. Yeah, it's always cold.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Cool. No, that's all right. So Victor meets the creature at the end of his section, and the creature says, you're horrible, and I'm going to tell you what happened, and you're going to listen to me.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not going to faint while I do it.
I will just wait till you wake up, buddy.
So he does. He starts to tell his story, and his story is just fascinating. So here's where, the cultural view of what Frankenstein's monster is very different from the actual book, because Frankenstein's monster is very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he stumbles around. It's like he's an 8-foot-tall infant. He doesn't know anything about anything. He can't speak any language, but he's got thoughts, right? And one of the things I remember is his discovery of fire. Mm-hmm. And he describes how, and he's describing this to Victor now that he's learned the language and everything, because it's been years. He's telling him that the fire was, it had light and warmth, and it was amazing. And then I plunged my hands into it, and it burned me. And I thought, oh, how could such a thing do both things? Mm-hmm. So he's thinking very philosophically about everything. And he's shunned by society, meaning whenever he meets people, he learns to avoid people very quickly because they're horrified by him. So he ends up hanging out outside a French family's house. So he hides in the woods, and he does things like cut their wood and things. It's like they have some kind of magical creature outside that they never see. And they get all this, free stuff happening. And in return, unbeknownst to the family, he listens and watches them constantly. And through that is where he learned the language, and also books. He got it mentions three books at that point. One of them is Paradise Lost, and one of them is Plutarch's Lives, and the other one is something about sorrow, the sorrows of some. It's a book that I hadn't heard of, but it sounds like some romantic era book about love to me.
Yeah.
And then the creature describes reading these books and how amazing it was to read these books and have his eyes opened. Earlier, I can't remember the circumstances, but earlier he'd read or had read to him a book about the fall of empires or something like that. And he talked about his sadness about how humanity keeps doing this to themselves.
Yeah, there's she's called The Arabian, although I believe she has the actual name. That's the one I remember right now. But this is essentially the fiance of the young man. This a poor family that's been, they're refugees, and this one day this the Arabian lady shows up. She's found them, and they're teaching her how to speak, French, I'm sorry, how to speak the language and how to read. And so they're reading out loud out of the book and studying it. And this is a wonderful device, not only to educate us to them and the philosophical concepts, but, the monster can learn how to read and speak, and he can speak more than one language now and all these various things. And so you're right. That's a passage I had marked because it was really interesting to see that he was born good and very innocent, and he just wanted someone to love him and accept him.
Yeah, he wanted community, right?
Yeah, he wanted community. I mean, like anybody would. And so he was content to watch and learn And then he, you know, with the hopes of someday I'm going to be, I could talk and I could go talk to them and this is going to be great. They'll know that I'm the one who helped them. And so your heart's just breaking the whole time for this monster. And then as you're seeing these concepts be introduced and he's suddenly thinking about how they apply to him as well as to people, this is when he gets a more sophisticated way of looking at things. And he suddenly goes, wait a minute. How do I fit into this whole thing? And he's starting to wrestle with the big questions of who am I? Why am I here? Where the heck is my creator?
Yeah.
And he starts to really hold a grudge, but he's still holding out hope that this family will be his friends.
So, yeah. Yeah. Yep. And I marked this passage about Paradise Lost that I love to read.
Yeah.
Because it's great. He says, this is the creature talking.
Yeah.
But Paradise Lost excited different and far deeper emotions. I read it as I had read the other volumes which had fallen into my hands as a true history. It moved every feeling of wonder and awe that the picture of an omnipotent God warring with his creatures was capable of exciting. I often referred the several situations as their similarities struck me to my own. Like Adam, I was apparently united by no link to any other being in existence. But his state was far different from mine in every other respect. He had come forth from the hands of God a perfect creature, happy and prosperous, guarded by the especial care of his Creator. He was allowed to converse with and acquire knowledge from beings of a superior nature. But I was wretched, helpless, and alone. Many times I considered Satan as the fitter emblem of my condition, for often, like him, when I viewed the bliss of my protectors, the bitter gall of envy rose within me.
Yeah, and he didn't even have the nurturing and the love that Adam had, and actually Satan too. Lucifer was the first of God's angels, the best of God's angels, who rebelled against God because of his pride. And so
that makes me make a connection with Victor and Lucifer.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a reverse. It's like Adam got cast out through no fault of his own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's real interesting to think about. And now I haven't read Paradise Lost.
Yeah, but, me neither. Yeah.
So I know just as little about it as I did about Frankenstein before I read it the first time.
Right. It's one of those things, again, we probably think we know about, but
yeah, but it is.
It. Yep.
Yeah, but it is a recurring theme that she's continually bringing up: creation, creator. And, you know, to call him the creature, that's, you know, God created the creatures of the earth, including the creature of man.
Yeah.
So.
And it's important to note, too, that when the creature left the laboratory, he took Victor's journal with him.
Oh, I forgot that.
And that, yep. So not only these other books, Paradise Lost and all this stuff, but he's got a journal filled with notes from his creator, and they include notes like how much he hates his creation and how horrible it was, because there was some time in between the final animation of the creature. There was time for Victor to write in his journal about, oh my gosh, what have I done? This is horrible. It's disgusting and wretched. And he got that written down in time for the monster to go ahead and pick that up and run with it.
No, I was looking at that going, what, in between the it's alive and, oh, holy crap. Yeah. Jots a few notes.
I have got to write this down. Yeah. So he's got in his pocket, you know, oh, I hate this thing, you know, love dad, which is, you know, just utter rejection.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's got this, you know, he desires community. He can't find community. And he's also got his creator's thoughts in his pocket about how horrible he is.
Right? Yeah, because when he finally does pick his moment to approach the old man of the family when everybody's gone and the old man is blind, then and he's fine talking to him. But when everybody comes in later, the monster's like, I really shouldn't have done it like that. I should have done it this way. But here's how you know, came mm-hmm. out was, you know, they all show up and see this horrible creature with their father. And so they naturally are like, oh, get away. What's going on? And he takes that as the ultimate rejection and says, fine, nobody wants me. I'll just be awful. And who should I be awful against? I know the person who brought me here to be miserable. I'm going to kill everybody Victor loves.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make them suffer.
Yeah. So so off he goes to Geneva because, again, he's got the notes and he knows where his creator is from. So mm-hmm. off he goes to where Victor lives. Now, that scene between the old man and the creature was just heart-wrenching.
Oh, yes.
You know, because he was just so thrilled to be talking to somebody. And the old man was blind. So, you know, he's not passing any judgment on this creature due to looks. Mm-hmm. And he's just talking to him. And then, like you said, when that family came in and they were just horrified and, you know, weren't able to listen to a thing that the creature had to say and kicked him out. And not only that, but they were so horrified that they ran away from their house and weren't going to come back. And he burned the whole place down. It was horrible. It was just, you know, an incredible scene.
Well, and to go back to that theme of, you know, it's that idea of you can have all the book smarts in the world, but you have no experience in dealing with people. And that's why he says later, he's like, well, now I realize I should have done it like this. But at the time, he burns the place down. He is like a child who's having a temper tantrum, and he's been rejected and hurt again and again, and he just strikes out. And later then, when he comes up with his revenge plan, it's also, it's surprisingly sophisticated, but it's, you know, in terms of, I'll leave him alive so he can suffer the way I'm suffering without anybody he loves around.
Petulant child, right.
Yeah, exactly. At the same time, it's like a teenager. Mm-hmm. So I'll show him.
Right.
Because he's got no life experience. He's, you know, and all along the way, Victor is presented with opportunities to change his behavior. Even if he doesn't really believe it himself, he could pretend and be nice to the monster. The monster's telling him, look, here's how I felt, here's why I'm doing this, but all Victor can do, and granted, there have been murders, I get it, but all Victor can do is go, oh, woe is me, why am I presented with this problem, he's the worst. He's so self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. So So the creature goes to Geneva, right? And he, I'm trying to remember the exact circumstance, but he runs into the little boy.
Yeah.
And he ends up killing the little boy. But it implies that it may not have been on purpose.
Mine just says it.
Yeah, because it says that he grabbed his throat to quiet the boy and killed him.
Yeah, he says, he's like, you know, despite everything I'd learned, I still thought maybe I could have a friend.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah, he didn't know his own strength, essentially.
Right. And that's the impression that I got, too. So, it didn't say he killed him out of anger and malice. It was just the kid wouldn't be quiet and he was going to be discovered. So he tried to silence him, but ended up killing the boy. And right. And Justine happened to be close by. She was sleeping close by, and she ended up getting blamed for the murder.
Well, he puts the locket that was around the boy's neck into her pocket because he knew she loved the little boy.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
And again, here's the thing where he's all the things he's doing to, despite him wanting to be bad,
mm-hmm.
he still wants to be friends with William. He wants to give Justine a little comfort. And what it does is basically they find the locket and go, aha, you know, he was killed for this valuable locket and it's in her pocket. She did it.
Right.
You know, so everything he does is wrong through the right motives.
Yeah. So so then he ends his tale to Victor. And then he tells Victor that you must make me a companion. I have got to have someone to hang out with. Stat, right? You know, you have taken away, you know, I have nothing. And I need a person. And he talks Victor into it through threats, right?
I was going to say, blackmails him into it, essentially. Right.
So Victor agrees reluctantly. And then he goes home and he says, I know you want to get married, but I'm going to go to London for a while and do some stuff, but I'll be back. So yeah. He tells Elizabeth that, and off he goes. He expects the creature to follow him. And then he works on, after a long while, he starts to work on, Frankenstein monster female. And
Frankenstein.
Yes, exactly. And it gets to a certain point and decides that he just can't go through with it. And then he goes out to sea to dispose of everything that he had created.
Yeah, he tears it apart and the creature sees him.
Right. And then
because he's just like, you know, the creature says, you know, if you do this, we'll go to South America. We'll live in the jungle together. I just need a friend.
Yeah.
And he says, we won't have any children. And of course, I'm thinking, well, they probably couldn't anyway, but still, you know, won't do anything. Don't worry. But all Frankenstein can think of is, what if they propagate? You know?
Yeah.
And go around killing more people. And I'm thinking, talk about Victor not being able to read people. I mean, you have no reason to think the monster would not keep his promise, in my opinion.
Yeah, true. Yeah, well, I agree with that. I keep thinking in Victor, too, you know, what the horrible things that he is doing to create these creatures. I just imagine his lab, and it's just like glossed over. It just says, you know, body parts or whatever, you know, all this stuff, and how horrified he does say that it's very horrifying and gives him the vapors. But, you know, it's just, you know, so, you know, to see all that created and what he did to put it together, and then, it's got to be hard to even do that. And it would color your perception of your creation, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're making this out of parts. You know, it'd be hard to even consider it a person. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he should, you know, he had all the evidence. Like you said, I'm not trying to defend Victor.
Oh, no.
But I
understand. And it's more acceptable for the first creation.
Mm-hmm.
Just than the second, except that it's all colored by his inability to see from anyone else's point of view. But you're right. From the first one, you don't know that there's essentially a soul in this creation, which we find out when the monster is talking to us or telling his story to Victor. And it kind of brings back that idea of these days that we struggle with. When is it convenient to ignore a living creature? How many of us are like Victor when we think about other people? Because there's that thing of Black Lives Matter, every Black Life Matters or whatever it's called, Black Lives Matter. But, you know, it's every life matters. Mm-hmm. And every life has the potential, you know, when you're talking about the unborn, it all has the potential to be like the creature, a living creature that needs love and could ostensibly enrich our lives in ways we can't foresee. The older lives matter, the ones that we don't want to listen to, that, they're in their living communities or whatever, and they can't get out. And, you know, just everybody who's marginalized, those are all people that are marginal. And I would contend that we've all got someone who we're afraid of dealing with or thinking about the same way Victor is of his monster, whether it's the homeless, whether it's, I mean, you know, or a political opposite, or, you know, whoever it is that you are afraid of or don't want to think about. We're just like Victor in those cases. And so that's where this book kind of, when you start to think of it like that, can we be like Walton?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Even one of the thoughts that came to my head this time as well was what he did to the female creature felt like an abortion. In fact, I think that the word abort was used at some point.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, to the point where he was pretty much on the last step and just destroyed it. It's hard not to think about that in today's light.
Well, I think that's why this is a timeless book. It has a lot to say to all of us. And if we are selective, we just look at it and want to accuse other people of it. That's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't done this, and I value this particular life that you don't pay attention to. Whether it's a friend of mine who says, well, but you're not out there helping these people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But she's not out there helping the other people that I care about. So where do we have to be honest enough to open up our own minds and go, just because I am thinking about only my point of view, or even only, a lot of times when we're looking at these people who we don't want to think about, it's, we might not even be thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about someone else's point of view. Like, talking about abortion, the people who are pro-abortion are really, they're trying to be kind to the mothers-to-be. Mm. They're not stopping to think about the point of view of the baby might actually be a blessing to this mother. We can't see it right now. So, or the other people might not be thinking about, you know, the elderly or the homeless people, or, you know, we're thinking about it from the point of view of we're trying to make life better for this other set of people that wind up leading to this group of people being marginalized. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
I do, yeah.
It's that community thing that you kept mentioning. It's that, where are we going to really open our minds and all think about community the right way? Because all these people are related to us in one way or another. And it really, if we can force ourselves out of the predictable mindsets, it enriches us all in some way, but we have to overcome our own fear, or, you know, that the blinders that we have on for whatever reason.
Right. Yeah, we definitely have those. Yeah.
I get off my soapbox.
No, I like it. I agree. That's good stuff. So let's see. So yeah, so he destroys his attempt at making a female, and then, you know, the monster and him have another exchange, because while he's out there at sea throwing the parts overboard, the creature comes up, and the creature is very angry, and he says, "I will be there on your wedding night." Right? And in capital letters, he says that.
I know. And so, then he has to go off and kill his best friend and get him blamed for the murder while he's at it.
Exactly.
I don't think that was intentional, the blaming for the murder, but it's all to the good.
Yeah. So, yeah, so Victor gets disentangled from that, but he ends up going home, and he ends up marrying Elizabeth. And the wedding night, he's like, okay, well, I've got to protect myself here. I'm going to make sure that there's no way that this creature can get to me. And in the meantime, the creature kills his wife.
Sure, because we all know. We're like, what has he been doing to hurt you the whole time, you idiot?
Right, right.
He's like, oh, I'm going to die. And then he's like, thinking things like, oh, poor Elizabeth. She'll be so sad because I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible for her because I'll be dead. Oh, it'll make her sad. And I'm like,
oh, man.
Oh, it's always about you, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
You can all see it coming, but.
Yep.
I wonder if the original readers could see it coming, too. I mean, this story is well known enough, the basics. So Walton is writing to his sister, this is a horrifying, blood-curdling tale. And is it horrifying and blood-curdling in the way it should be? I mean, parts of it are definitely horrifying, but
yeah. I don't know either. I wonder. It seemed obvious to me, but, you know, I guess as a modern reader who's read lots of stories, you know, you're like, dude, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious, but it's wrenching, too, because you're like, oh, go back, you know, what are you doing? But yeah, she ends up, you know, paying the price for him.
Plus, he lied to Elizabeth, or by omission,
mm-hmm.
the whole time. I mean, he doesn't trust her at all, because I guess because she's a delicate blossom, or, you know, he just can't bear to reveal everything, because she keeps saying, "What's wrong, honey?" And he says, "I'll tell you, but I have a horrible, horrible secret. I'll tell you after we're married." Now, if I was Elizabeth, I'd be going, "Well, hold on. Let's talk now." And she didn't take that tact. She went,
"Horrible secret, yeah."
"All right, one big secret, and I'll tell you later." And I'm thinking, because after you're married, you can't get out of it? Because after you're married, you can't tell? Because you can't reject him after you're married? I mean, what the what?
Yeah, exactly.
No, he's just the worst.
And she accepted that, yeah.
Yeah, they're very passive.
Very.
It's women.
You bet. So, yeah, so then Victor starts to chase the monster, and that's where the story catches back up to the framing story.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that Walton... It's funny, Walton parallels both the creature in a way and Victor Frankenstein in a way, because he writes to his sister and says, "Well, you know, for 6 years I tried to, I believe it was, write epic poetry, and I couldn't do it, and I was so upset. But now I'm going to make a discovery that no one else has made, and I'm going to be super famous."
That's right.
And he's not doing anything because he wants to genuine knowledge. He wants to do it because he wants to be important, which echoes what Victor says later about, "I'll be the creator of a new race. They'll worship me." And at the same time, he's desperately lonely. He doesn't know anyone like himself who's interested in exploring and investigating and the That's intellectual right, yeah. part.
Yeah, and he laments that fact. He says, I got no one to talk to.
Right.
Yeah.
And he really, really, really wants a friend. And almost as soon as he talks to Victor, who must be the most charismatic person on earth, he's like, "Oh, this could be him. Oh, my gosh." But Victor is obviously fading. And the doctor says, you know, he's not going to live very long. He's just used himself up on whatever it is he's been doing. And so at one point, Walton says, "Must I then lose this admirable being? I have longed for a friend. I have sought one who would sympathize with and love me. Behold, on these desert seas, I have found such a one, but I fear I have gained him only to know his value and lose him. I would reconcile him to life, but he repulses the idea." So see, he's not even trying to live anymore. He's just giving up because it won't go his way. "I thank you, Walton," he said, "for your kind intentions towards so miserable a wretch. But when you speak of new ties and fresh affections, think you that any can replace those who are gone? Can any man be to me as Clerval was, or any woman another Elizabeth?" And so he's like, you know, that's great, but you're not good enough. You can't replace them, and I won't even give you the chance. And so he's being rejected by this guy just the same way that the monster was rejected.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Good enough.
Good point.
It just struck me because I was like, "Oh, Victor, still just thinking of ourselves, not, oh, I could help this guy." No. You can't replace people for me, and that's no good. So he's still just as selfish. And then when the men are all going, "Okay, we're trapped in the ice. And when the ice opens up, we need to leave right away or we will all die." And so Walton's thinking, "Well, what do I do? We could have this great experiment, but, you know, I don't want to kill everybody. That would be terrible." So we see his moral dilemma is very, very briefly reflecting the one that Frankenstein has, right?
Mm-hmm.
What should I do? Should I press on regardless of everybody around me, or should I think of other people? And so he's like, "Well, Maybe I should do it. I think there's going to be a mutiny." And then Vic Frankenstein has been listening. And then he says, "He now roused himself. His eyes sparkled and his cheeks flushed with momentary vigor. Turning toward the men, he said, 'What do you mean? What do you demand of your captain? Are you then so easily turned from your design? Did you not call this a glorious expedition? And wherefore was it glorious? Not because the way was smooth and placid as a southern sea, but because it was full of dangers and terrors, because at every new incident your fortitude was to be called forth and your courage exhibited, because danger and death surrounded, and these dangers you were to brave and overcome. And then he goes on and he's like, oh, do not return to your families with the stigma of disgrace marked on your brows. Return as heroes who have fought and conquered and who knows not what it is to turn their backs on their foes. And he says, Walton says, well, the men were moved and they didn't know what to say. And he said, you know, go ahead and think about it. And then if you still want to turn back, we'll do it. You just go talk about all these things and come back. Mm-hmm. And so Frankenstein is still the same as ever. It's all about the glory and the, you know, the danger and the honors you'll get when you go back versus going back and saying maybe that you failed, but you're alive. And Walton, eventually, his men say, no, we've decided we want to live. And he goes, okay, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. So he's not victor. And he's even kind to the monster. As much as he likes Victor, when Victor's dead and the monster shows up and says, damn it, now what do I have to live for? Nothing.
Yep.
Revenge was all I had. And right. He's like, well, you know, come on. And he's the only other one who's ever had a conversation with the monster while he's looking at him.
You know? Yeah, and you say that and you're like, well, that's the perfect companion for this guy. I mean, he'd be good to talk to, the creature.
yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that. Yeah. But he can't live at the North Pole, which evidently is where either the monster is going to kill himself or not. I know one of the changes between in the 1830 version, the way it's worded makes it sound more final when the monster leaves.
In the later version, it's more final?
That's what they say. Okay. It's like it was all past tense, as if he's definitely going to go throw himself on a funeral pyre. In this one, it says he sprung from the cabin window, as he said this, upon the ice raft, which lay close to the vessel. He was soon borne away by the waves and lost in darkness and distance. And they said that kind of leaves a little open door of, you don't know if he'll really do it or not.
Right, right. Frankenstein Part 2.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I like that. That's interesting. I like the ambiguity. They should leave that open. Mm-hmm. I like the less final. In the 1818 version.
Yeah, because you know that Walton does live long enough to write this last letter.
Yeah.
And send it off or whatever.
Or whatever, yeah. It's like, you know, where is he sending these letters? It's you know, he's got to just be writing them all and they're sitting there on the boat somewhere.
Yeah, I guess the first ones are before he leaves, so those have been sent. But yeah, the last ones are, I guess, just written and waiting to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating.
It's such an interesting book because you've got the whole, this duality, the contrast between the two main people. And then once I figured out, I don't know why, I'm sure I read something that pointed me in this direction, but Walton as kind of the link. And the idea that you can change, you can be a better person despite wanting these things without any moral responsibility. I mean, he's not necessarily immoral. Victor doesn't care about morality at all.
Yeah. Yeah, and you'd hope the same for the creature, too. Mm-hmm. That the creature could get past obsession with his creator and live life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that hope.
Even if he goes to South America and is just living, you know, with the birds and the creeps in the jungle or whatever.
Yeah. Any place is probably better than the North Pole.
You would really feel that way. Or maybe
I would think so.
Everybody's so super civilized there. Mm-hmm. Well, and I saw something that said that they thought this was Mary Shelley's condemnation of ambition. But ambition is okay. Walton has ambition. You just can't pursue it at the expense of everything and everybody around you. You can't be totally self-absorbed. And that's really the key, I think.
Yeah. And I guess the thought about dangerous knowledge, too. And there's a parallel there between Walton and Frankenstein, you know, that kind of matches what you were saying. But it is like, yeah, it's like the pursuit of that despite consequences. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, Victor accepted no consequences, and Walton at the end did accept the consequences, like you said, and made a decision. But the ruthless pursuit of that knowledge is dangerous, right?
Yeah, just because we can do something, should we
do it? Exactly. And it's dangerous not only to the person that's not thinking about the consequences, but also society and everything else, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you unleash this on the unsuspecting public.
Right.
And you don't even know what it will do. Oh, good, it's gone. You know, mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about it. And you've got genetic tinkering and all these various things, you know.
Yeah. And it's not only that, but it could even be generalized to, you know, our personal lives.
Good point.
The things that we do daily with, you know, everything has consequences, right?
Mm-hmm.
And ripples.
Well, and that's an interesting point. What dangerous knowledge do we expose ourselves to when maybe we know better that it's like the fire? You know, it can both warm you and cook your food and be a wonderful tool, but if you stick your hand in it, you're going to get burned. And where's that line? Or, you know, in the Catholic Church, that's the idea of don't place yourself near an occasion of sin. Like, I'm like, men are tempted to pornography.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you stay away from things that, if that's your particular failing, how do you stay away from things that are going to make you just want just a little bit more?
Yeah.
And that can apply to any of us. There are all kinds of things that we all struggle with in our lives. But
sure. Yeah. And I like the Catholic Church not being fearful of saying, hey, wait a minute, everybody. You know, do we need to clone this sheep? is there a reason? What is our end result here? And it's not always them standing up and banning things. It's like, let's think about this. What are you doing? Why are we doing this? Is this worthy of us to do?
Let's just slow down.
And the thing is, you know, there's answers to that. I know a lot of people think that, you know, science for science's sake, whatever, you know, but that's not acceptable. You know, you have to think about, you know, I'm sure that we all wish that nuclear weapons did not exist.
Yeah.
You know, but they do. You know, are we just going to keep going and keep finding other things? You know, and at the same time, those thoughts create in me, well, you know, everything's got a good and a bad side. It's like, you know, well, nuclear energy might be good for us to have to heat our houses, you know, but mm-hmm. it's also got the bad side. The internet's got the good and the bad side.
Right.
It's in how we use it. So, you know, all these thoughts, this makes all these thoughts come to light and kind of churn away in my head.
Yeah. Well, and these things are tools. And then when, you know, personally, it comes down to things like there's knowledge out there that's maybe not good for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does that same thing. It's good for some people, not good for me. And I remember Jennifer Fitz wrote something about the occasion of sin idea.
Mm-hmm.
She said, and people will say, well, you know, if you're good enough, if you're a good enough Christian, you should be able to be around that, I don't know, the box of chocolate that you shouldn't be eating because you're dangerously overweight or whatever. I'm not going to take anything out of my own personal life. I'm just going to say you're struggling against it. And so the thing is that she said, she's like, guess what? We're not that perfect. Just be smart. Mm-hmm. Stay away from it. Get it out of the house, or, you know, don't use that part of the internet that's not good for you, or whatever, you know, keep an eye on yourself.
Yeah.
Be aware, be self-aware, because that's why they have these rules, is because, and the thing I like about the Catholic Church is, and that idea of the occasion of sin is, they don't sit there and lay out, here are all these things that could be bad. Like, you know, some Christian denominations will say, well, you shouldn't dance, or you shouldn't play cards, or you shouldn't drink, or you shouldn't gamble. And the church says, well, you know, some people can handle this stuff and some people can't. you have to be aware of who you are and stay away from the things that aren't good for you. That's okay for this other person. We're not going to lay down a blanket rule about this. Some things are definitely not good for you. Adultery, terrible. Never do it. You know, these are more difficult issues. Murder, no. But there's so many lesser ones that we struggle with. You know, Victor's creation is a huge one. So
yeah, for sure.
I mean, he's going where only God should go, essentially. Or, you know, people who are meant to create, like, you know, man and woman together, not by yourself in a lab with pieces of bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Catholic teachings is one of the things I love so much that we've mentioned before is all truth is of God. It's a little bit, it's another facet of a way to see part of who God is and to get closer if that's the way your mind, you know, bends that way. He gave us our brains, gave us our capacity for creativity and curiosity and all that. And that's, we're made in his image. So why wouldn't we want to find out the things that we do? I mean, that's, it's really exciting.
It really is. It really is.
To know that stuff, like you say, but it's to be responsible,
mm-hmm.
to consider consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And the other thing that this book really makes me think about that I really like to think about is the idea of monstrosity. And you touched on this earlier, but it's the idea of who it is that we reject and why, or what it is in life that we turn away from because of maybe biases or knowledge that we think we have that maybe is not correct.
Oh yeah,
The things that we turn away from that don't deserve us turning away from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's worth thinking about, and because, you know, on the surface, you know, Frankenstein's monster, the creature, is the monster of the story, but clearly, when I read it, it's Victor that's the monster,
mm-hmm.
and the creature is really kind of amazing, right?
Oh yeah,
it's Victor's obsessive hatred that's difficult, and
right.
and the creature who's constantly striving to be noble, you know, despite incredible odds, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got as big a headwind as a person has ever had.
Yeah.
And I do call the creature a person, you know, because he is.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and even when he's declared that he's going to be evil, he can't help himself trying to make a friend still, or mm-hmm. to help someone.
Yeah.
Goes wrong, but
right.
he's still got that good impulse, and also, you know, when you think about what the Romantics thought, which was, you know, beauty reflects what's good, so she deliberately took that and turned it on its head and essentially said what Peter's vision on that rooftop when he was at prayer and he saw the blanket, I guess, whatever, all this food presented to him that was unclean. And he says, well, I would never eat it. And God says to him, no, don't you get it? It's not what goes into a man. It's what is inside of him that is good or bad. And that's after that, he goes down and baptizes everybody in the Romans household. Doesn't matter that they're Gentiles. And that's kind of, it's a clumsy way for me to express it. And there's probably something better that expresses that. But it's that whole idea of your intentions. Who are you inside?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's interesting that you said, you know, it was a romantic point of view that beauty equals good,
mm-hmm.
right? And boy, if we aren't living in a society that thinks that beauty equals good.
Or exterior reflects the interior. I mean, you think of what Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner put themselves through,
mm-hmm.
him, herself through. I'm like, but you're still the same person inside. Now, I have to admit, I don't understand this whole thing, so mm-hmm. I guess I'm a troglodyte to some. But but it's that thing of, in these days, you could do anything. And does that change the inner search for happiness? Does it change who you are? You know,
mm-hmm.
I it's that idea that the external really does reflect the internal, and it can't for any of us. I mean, aren't you sometimes surprised when you look in the mirror? I am. I'm like,
oh, yeah. I definitely am. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, wow.
Yeah.
Where'd that guy go?
I know. And I'm trying to think of what I was reading where I think I might have been looking at my dogs. And one of our dogs is, you know, a gorgeous, almost a creature size. He's a huge boxer. Mm-hmm. And everybody, oh, he's so wonderful and noble looking. And the other dog looks like somebody put her together out of spare parts. Her head is huge. Her hind end is tiny. She's got giant bulldog shoulders. She looks like a cartoon bulldog in a way of, like, she'll tip over.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk to her and go, oh, you're so funny looking. And I'm like, I realize neither of them knows what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
They know what we look like. They have, even if they saw themselves in a mirror, they wouldn't understand it. And I'm like, that's essentially how we live and how most of, you know, civilization has been. I mean, you could see yourself in a stream maybe, or,
mm-hmm.
And it's what's inside is what counts. You know,
yeah.
Can that overcome how people see you? Can that overcome, you know, the externals, the monstrous thing?
Right. Yeah. Agreed.
And that's, I guess, why it's so important to try to connect with God personally, because He does know us from the inside out.
Right. He knows us. He knows the important parts.
Better than we know ourselves.
Better than we know ourselves. Yep. Yep. Agreed. Well, good. Wow. Well, that was fun.
Yeah. Great.
I enjoy this book. So great. Thanks for agreeing to do it.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
I was so excited when you picked it.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So what's next? Next up, we have a movie, Gone Baby Gone.
Yes.
Not to be confused with Gone Girl.
No.
Though it shares an actor.
Ben Affleck is in both.
Cool.
Yeah, this is, it's not necessarily the most, when you watch it, don't have your young children around. It's mm-hmm. got profanity and violence, but it's a really great movie.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll be fun.
Okay, cool. All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Back in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.